I'm going to hand the meeting over to Robert, who's kindly agreed to come and share with us today. Thanks, Robert.
Thanks a lot, Jan. Thanks for asking me, and thank you all for being here. Yeah, I'm Bob or Robert G from Jersey City, New Jersey. My sobriety date is April 20th, 2004. And I have a sponsor. I've done traditional AA. I've done agnostic AA almost from the beginning. I went to my first agnostic meeting on January 2nd, 2005 at the LGBT now Q Center in Jersey City on 13, I mean in New York City on 13th Street. Burgeoning at the time, it was a burgeoning agnostic and secular meetings were going on around the city. It's really blown up since then. I'm actually speaking on another Zoom platform, a Zoom meeting, I mean, on Monday night, which I was just asked after this one. I don't know why I said yes to that either. But yeah, it's good to be able to it's good to be able to be part of this, actually. And it's really changed the whole dynamic of my life. I was like a lot of the things that are said in traditional AA and have been formatted in AA have been true to me. The self-seeking, the primacy of my ego. In all my relationships, even though it was very distorted, where the things that the chief agents in my active addictions, and it was it's been a long journey. I'm not a ready-made member of AA. I planned on not I if I planned on anything, it was not sticking around. I was busted up when I came in my first meeting for actual AA was in May. So it's a few weeks, almost a month after I quit drinking and drugging. I'll just preface it by saying in April 1st, April Fool's Day, I tried to quit smoking, drinking, and doing drugs that weekend, whatever it was around that time. And it was an ambitious that was an ambitious goal. This is somebody who always woke up on the floor of his kitchen with things surrounding him that he considered essential. So but I it was like my habit to live in my kitchen at the time. So I moved my favorite chair in the kitchen. I moved my stereo in the kitchen. Everything was in the kitchen, and I still woke up on the floor, everything but my bed. Yeah, I got busted up. I don't know how it happened. I was in a complete blackout. I broke my leg. I broke a rib. My face was all busted up. I had a tooth hanging down. I ended up doing my own dentistry as a consequence. I was what they would call non-compliant when I went to the hospital and I got my cast. I was still walking on my leg, even though doctors were like, "You're going to ruin your leg if you keep this up." I went through a couple of casts. I didn't stop drinking right away, but I did quit smoking. That weekend, I ended up quitting smoking, and I tried to go back a few times when I was still drinking, and it would make me gag. It would really made me. I was a 2.5 to 3 pack a day smoker, so it was a lot. I smoked a lot, and like everything I did way over the top. So that was one of the good things because if had I come into AA and I was still smoking, it would be I'd probably still be smoking, I'd think, and probably be smoking a lot or. You know, but I don't know. I don't know that for certain. But I did quit drinking on April 20th. I remember that because it was Secretary's Day or Administrative Assistance Day in America, and I had to do some kind of intake at the hospital for I don't even remember what, but I met a woman who would end up being my neighbor, and she was the first person that said, "Well, there's programs for people like you." And I was like, "What does that mean?" That came out of the blue. While I was sitting down to do this intake, she was like giving me advice to maybe I should probably sober up. But she did it in such an offhand way that it really didn't sink in. But I do remember that. That's how April 20th stuck with me. It's one of those floating holidays. It doesn't really You don't get a day off for it. You get like a balloon and a card from your boss, apparently. Maybe some cake. But so anyway, that first year was really difficult. I really didn't want to stay in AA. I had a sister. I have to say that too. My sister got sober in Ireland probably 10 years before. I think she's got 33 years or 30, I think it's 33 years now she has. So she got sober 13 years before me. And I knew all about it. I wished her well. I was actually very helpful in some aspects that she remembered. And I have to say this too, is I was trying to keep this dreadful accident I had, where I broke all my bones and stuff like that, and a secret from my family. And it was obvious I wasn't going to be able to work for a while. I had no resources, even though I had made a ton of money in the previous 6 months. Nothing left. I owed a shit ton of money to credit cards and back taxes and all kinds of things that would become really weigh on me heavily in the first year or so of sobriety. So but I was determined not to let my family know. And luckily for me, I had an ex-girlfriend. She was a good friend of mine who told my ex-sister-in-law what was going on. And that she said to her that his plan is to go to the homeless shelter. That's his plan. And that was my plan. I was going to go to the homeless shelter, which at the time is a really archaic old building. It was about 150 years old. Everything was stairs, no air conditioning. And at the time, and I mean, thankfully it was the spring, but that was my plan. My plan was to just not let anyone know and to handle it all on my own. And yeah, that's kind of crazy thinking about it in retrospect. But as my family found out, they kind of circled the wagons around me. That's one thing about my family that's really good is when there's a crisis, they get in your life. And they did in that way. We did it with my younger brother when he got divorced, and we did it with other family members when they were sick. And so even though we have our issues, we do that thing fairly well. So that's what they did with me. And I was really embarrassed. I was mortified. I did not realize just what a gift this woman did for me, gave to me. And my family got involved in my life. And my sister from who lived in Ireland, she lives in Dunleary now. She was living in Cork at the time. She called me regularly and not hounded me, but told me, like in no uncertain terms, that I should give AA a try, that I am in no position to sort of just shrug it off, just give it a shot. And again, I took some time. I was living on a fourth floor walk up with a the last landing was a nice big curved staircase. And if anyone has ever had to walk crutches on stairs, know that it's difficult to begin with. But to do it with a broken rib and crutches and to try to go up those stairs was like it made me very homebound, put it that way. Even though there was a liquor store around the corner, and the proprietor of the liquor store held me with contempt because I was such a drunk, but his name was George, and interesting guy. I actually became friends with him ultimately, but you know, I couldn't get out and do the things I wanted to, so I was stuck in my apartment, and this one girlfriend of mine, ex-girlfriend, would bring me beer. She wouldn't bring me whiskey. She wouldn't bring me vodka. She wouldn't bring me any of the liquors I would choose over beer, but she would bring me beer because she didn't want to see me go into seizures, and she had a taste of that. So she brought me these big cans of Old Milwaukee, 16 ounces, and bring two 6-packs at a time. And I nursed those for those first few weeks after my accident before I quit drinking. And then one night I worked up. I know I'm going back and forth a little bit, and I'm sorry about that for the disorder, but this is before I quit drinking and before I had that moment on April 20th. On April 19th, I went to a bar. I had about $20 in my pocket, and I went to the bar and I spoke to the bartender, and he was nice guy. It was very close to my house. I actually drove there, which was insane because I have a clutch. My truck had a clutch, and to drive with a broken leg, period, is nuts. But to drive with a clutch and a broken leg is really insane. But I drove over to his bar, and this bar, Bobby D's, and I told him my situation. I said, I don't have a lot of money, but I need to get fortified. And I said, but when I do have money, I'll come back and I'll take care of you. And he said, right on, man, I got you. And he said, what's your pleasure? And I said, Jim Beam. And he gave me basically, he opened a bottle of Jim Beam for me, and I drank a good chunk of it with him. He helped me out a little bit, and he gave me short beers. And we had a really great conversation. He had been in AA 2 years prior. And he said, they're really lovely people. They're great people. Because I was telling him, like, all my complaints, like, oh, these, everyone wants me to join AA and I have no desire. And he, like, my sister's in it. He goes, no, they're really like, they'll help you. They're really nice. But he goes, they're very serious about not drinking. So I was like, fuck. Yeah, that's not what I wanted to hear. But the one thing that happened to me that night that I never saw happening before was I couldn't get drunk. No matter how much he gave me, I couldn't get drunk. And, I went home. I mean, I should have been shit faced. I went home, and the next day when I woke up, I did just sort of just pass out, even though I wasn't shit faced. I had to do this intake that morning, on the 20th of April, and that's how I knew it was the 20th. So I forget where I left off to go down that avenue, but it was, I went to my first meeting at a meeting in the city on May 15th or 16th, and I drove because a friend of mine was going to that meeting supposedly regularly, and I didn't know this at the time, but he was still drinking, and he only went to that meeting because there were like a lot of attractive young women there, and younger. They weren't young; they were in their 30s and 40s at the time, but so I tagged along. I went with him, and you got to remember, I'm busted up and I look like hell. I look like I'm homeless. And I ended up going to this meeting the first time. And, there had to be 60 or 70 people at it. It was a speaker step meeting. And one of the shares was this Irish kid who was talking about being sober 2 years at the time. And he was going on vacation with his brother, and he said, you don't understand, this is huge. I haven't had a real relationship with my brother in years, and we used to do everything together, and I really love my brother, but he's really held me in contempt and at a distance because of my drinking and using and my lackadaisical life. And I was like, oh fuck, that's exactly my experience with my younger brother. I was really tight with him. I love my nieces. I get along great with them, his daughters. And but I've been more and more remote from their lives and his life as a consequence. And he's very judgmental about my behavior and how I would behave. I very rarely got drunk around him at that point because I couldn't get drunk the way I would like to. But even at family gatherings, I found myself saying things that were upset him. And I really alienated him. And we hadn't done anything together in years, and it really hurt. And to hear this guy say it was my first identification with anybody in AA. And my first meeting, I have to say that that was a good primer, because I had to offset that. I had like a shit ton of judgment. I was always judging people. And even in that meeting, people would share, and I thought, oh, listen to this fucking hipster, listen to these. I could write them off. I could rationalize not relating to them. And I think too is like, that's the thing, that when I did change over and become more accessible about getting sober in like a, I'm going to say, spiritual sense or psychological proactive sense, it was when I stopped, when the judging overruled the identification, when I start really identifying people and learning how to listen. We were talking about listening today in an earlier meeting on Tasnua. And I think that was the thing, is it wasn't always about me. I mean, I still have all this noise in my head, me, 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 but it's about listening to people and trying to comprehend what they're going through and how to relate to that. And I think those were huge breakthrough moments that didn't happen overnight for me in AA. They happened very, very slowly. But okay, I'll say this. I was at nine, at 7 months or 6 months. So April, May, June, July, August, September, October. October, I didn't have, of that first year, I lost my crutches. I was allowed to walk. And I was so full of hate and anger about the groups that I was going to, the traditional groups, that I ended up just started going out to meetings all over the city, New York City. And most of them were still traditional. Very, my first agnostic meeting wasn't until January 2nd. So they were all traditional in that sense, but some were a little bit lighter than others. And a lot of it was just, I wanted to socialize. I wanted to be around people. I wanted to have other people around me. And I didn't want to be preached to. And it was nice having that sort of ambulatory kind of sobriety at first, you know? But I did learn a lot during that time too. I learned what I didn't want to hear. I didn't want to be part of the more cultish aspects of AA, the more Slav, you know, dictatorial or authoritarian. I wanted to be away from that. When I finally did make up my mind to go to the agnostic meetings, it was on January 2nd. I had known about it for a month, so it was a month or so, but I had just been really dragging ass. And again, I'm in constant conversation with my sister in Ireland, and she's like saying, just do it, just go, you'll love it, you'll enjoy it, these are your types of people, go. And I don't know why, but you know, anyway, I went to the meeting on January 2nd, 2005. I introduced myself, but that's all I did. And I heard all these wonderful people share, and they shared about everything under the sun. They're mostly like what we do in like agnostic AA or in other fellowships that don't get to, well, the traditional AA is like we sort of badmouth AA, sort of unites us in our cause, at least initially. And but man, they were so great, because like once I did start talking, like everything, the doors fell off, everything, all my emotional frailties and all of that shit started coming out. And sometimes people would laugh, and at first I got upset, but then I started laughing with them, and they would just tell me all the time, I keep coming back, man. We love you. We think you're great and you're very funny. And I just kept coming back. And I didn't abandon traditional AA or even the groups that I went to in Jersey City. I kept going back to that. There's a real argumentative quality about my early sobriety. I love to argue. I love to push points and push people's buttons, or at least I did. And you know, and I did that pretty effectively at various points in at the Barrow Mansion, where a few of you might know about, but it's a place in Jersey City that has like, it's like a nerve center for all things AA. But I went back there. I also made a lot of friends there, two people who really were lovely and kind to me coming up. And I have to say that, you know, it wasn't all about arguing. It was me really finding a home, trying to find a home. And so anyway, I'll fast forward a little bit. I didn't believe in the whole sponsorship thing. I entertained that idea initially, and I thought, I don't really need that. I'll just let the group sort of sponsor me, at least initially, when I figure it out. And okay, on the 10th month, I'm sorry, on that 7th month, when I ended up losing my crutches and going around being more mobile, they were all talking about the 10th step in meetings I went to. It was October, 10th step. Seemed to go hand in hand. I just thought it was a thing in AA at the time. I didn't realize it was sort of not necessarily, but I heard all these people say this wonderful practical stuff on how to deal with life on life's terms stuff. They were like, you know, they would make up spot check inventories, or they would do these more involved things every night before they went to bed. They would you know, report on themselves to themselves about how they dealt with their day and how they were moving through their lives and stuff like that. And it was this honest kind of look at your life and how you like keeping your side of the street clean. That was another thing, like seeing my part in things. I really was very slow learner. I didn't get any of that until I started hearing other people talk about it in very concrete ways. So that was a big thing for me. Like, I started doing a 10th step before I was really fully sold on first and second and third steps and stuff like that. So that was huge. And I was on a job that I had just gone back to work after being disabled. And I was getting into argument. I'm in construction. I was getting into arguments and fights with guys that I used to party with on a regular basis. And so it was timely that I would hear this message about, seeing where, what was I doing to make a bad situation worse, or what was I doing to exacerbate anything? And I'd like to say it was like an immediate success story. It wasn't. It was just like, I just sort of, it allowed me some distance between me and my feeling immediately to react. And that was the first time I ever did that in my life that I know of on a regular basis with any kind of discipline. But the thing was, is, like I said, I didn't start yet with agnostics. That would come a few months later. And when I did start going regular to the agnostics, I made that my home group. And I dove in. I did every aspect of their service for 5 years, 6 years. I enjoyed going to the agnostic meetings. I was a bit with blinders on. I only went to one or two, but I went to them regularly. And I became really enamored with it. And I also went to regular traditional meetings because I like that. And as a few of you know, I go to this homeless shelter regularly, and I've been doing that almost since the beginning. Mainly because I was around, I used to go to that homeless shelter because that was where I was going to end up. That was where I was going to be in my head. Once I ran out of money and they got tossed me out of the house, that was where I would end up. And so when I went there and I met people who did things like that, it made me realize I really dodged a bullet there. My thinking was very, very twisted. So I've been going back ever since in one form or another. The only hiatus I've ever had that was any length is during COVID, and we went on Zoom, and it really wasn't the same. You can't have a Zoom meeting that's in a homeless shelter exclusively on Zoom. It just, at least at this stage of the game, it doesn't really hold together. It's helpful for individuals, but it's not helpful for that milieu, at least in my experience. And so I've been going there ever since. I still go there regularly and I still love it. So I was doing that even then. I still did some service at the Barrow. I've always found myself doing service, but again, I didn't have a sponsor. And one time I was going to ask this one local, he was a loon. He just died a couple of years ago, sadly. I grew to love him very much. I was going to ask him to be my sponsor, but he was a real gadfly. It's like, it's a wonder if he was even an alcoholic or not, but he was definitely knee deep in every 12-step program and platform before he passed. And he was a very interesting guy, very intelligent, gnomic kind of quality about him. But anyway, I was going to ask him to be my sponsor, and I grew really frustrated because he had me clean his apartment, and he was a real clutterer, a real hoarder. And it was like deer paths through his apartment. And anything I chose to help clean, I brought these big contractor bags. And I wanted to fill them. I was filling them up with stuff, and he's following behind me, taking things out. And one good thing about it is I found a bunch of money that he had lost in this mess. And but anyway, I knew after being with him for just a few hours, I was not going to ask him to be my sponsor. But the good thing was I did that for 2 weekends. I helped him sort of organize his mess, and he gave me these really wonderful, memorable gifts, which I won't bring up. One was his. He was in the Korean War, and he gave me a flashlight and a toolbox that he had from that time. He gave me this other beautiful teapot, just a beautiful teapot. It fell apart, unfortunately, and a tapestry from the Ukraine that some relative of his had given him, because that's where his people were from originally. They came here during the pogroms, and his name was Fred. He was a very interesting guy. I still have the tapestry. I tried to give it to his family at his funeral, but they were like, nah, you hold on to it. It's a bizarre thing. It's a bizarre monument to him. But anyway, I left his house and I was heading home, and I was super frustrated, and I felt like I was covered with dust mites. It was a really hot September day, right around this time of year. And I ended up walking towards this very busy section of town, Journal Square, on this beautiful day, and I run into a guy from the program. He's a short fellow. He's neatly dressed. I've heard him speak before. I love what he's always had to say. And we got to talking for a while, and he was laughing that I was thinking about adding Fred as my sponsor. And he said, "Yeah, Fred's a good man. He's good peeps." And I said, "Well, what about you? You want to be my sponsor?" And it looked like I kicked him in the nuts, man. He was like, no. He's like 75 at the time. I think he was on cruise control. Like, he didn't really want to have a sponsee. And he said, after we talked a little bit more, and he goes, "Okay, this is the deal. It's just one alcoholic helping another. I'll help you out as much as I can. I'll take you as far as I can go." And he goes, "But you ain't sleeping on my couch, and I'm not lending you money." So I was like, "Fair enough." I was back to working full time by then. This is almost a year and a half after I got sober. So this is my first sponsor and my only sponsor. He ended up becoming my sponsor, and we did all the work together, and in part through men's retreats. We went to men's retreats and stuff that he was a little, we did it as a group effort in some ways. But I did my fourth and fifth with him, and that was a real experience. That was an amazing experience, not in a 100% positive way, but it made me very afraid because he told me his whole story, and it was, he knew I was going to be very judgmental, and I was. I didn't want to see him again afterwards, and because he told me some stuff that was really rough for me to deal with. And but I did, I had to see him. I really love the guy, and he's still my sponsor. Like I said, he's moved to North Carolina. He's 95 years old, and and we get along great. I'm going to go see him hopefully in a couple of weeks, and but he's been the only guy that I've ever actually had that kind of experience with, and it's opened doors for me in both being honest and not being judgmental as much as I was anyway. That's like the first 2 years of my sobriety. So I'm going to jump a little forward. A lot has happened in the interim, but I don't want to be stuck, just motoring through all this stuff, and leave you people hanging at the end. I'm going to say, like, up a few years ago, it became obvious that my sister couldn't deal with my mother any longer. My mother had dementia. My mother's personality didn't change at all. My sister just was disturbed by my mother's very existence. And she did some really underhanded things with her, which filled my whole family with, disgust with my sister. But we hatched a plan where we would take my mother out of that environment. And that was 2016. We started talking about it, or actually late 2015. 2016. It became critical. My mom was losing a lot of weight and everything, so it became my responsibility at that point, with the help of my brothers and sisters, that we were going to take my mom out of that environment and find a better place for her. She didn't need to be in a home. Her dementia was a little bit, pronounced, mostly just not remembering anything and stuff like that. But she still had a really sweet personality, really loving, and I couldn't see her in a home anyway. So I ended up in 2017 taking over the care of her. And I am the least likely person in my family to do something like that, period. I am not the one who's responsible. I'm not the one who's like, you go to for loving advice. It's not, that's not how I was formed, so to speak. But I took over care of my mom in April of 2000, no, May of 2017. And, it was difficult. It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. But I never, ever could have, A, have even anticipated being able to do it prior to getting straight, but also prior to being like really doing a lot of work. Like, AA opened the door for me to do a lot of stuff. I know this isn't an AA meeting per se, but we all followed step work somehow. And I definitely benefited from it. I mean, it made me really sort of really go through my life with a fine-tooth comb in my personal relationships and actions with people on a regular basis, which I was not willing to do. And some days I'm still not willing to do. And I'll illustrate that too a little later, hopefully not too much later. But I ended up taking over the care of my mom. My older brother helped me. The house I'm living in now, I rented it from a guy. He was like, he heard that what I was doing, and he changed directions with who he was going to rent the place to. And he rented it to me at a considerable loss, $500 a month. He knocked off the price because I couldn't afford it. It had everything we needed, but I had to, like, gut the inside, put up new doors, make this whole front first floor mom accessible, and has a kitchen, a bathroom, and a large living room, which became her bedroom. And my older brother and I did most of the work here. And it was really great. He and I have had a difficult relationship as kids, and it grew into a nice relationship. And he has a really super relationship with my mother, so it was good for him to be involved in it. And so we got this place shipshape. She moved in. It was difficult. My girlfriend was moved in with us. She thought it was going to be a little bit more like a TV comedy or something. I don't know. And it didn't work. So she was out 9 months later or 10 months later. But and she also knew, like, I wasn't going to just put my mom in a home, no matter how awkward things got. And again, yeah, I know I'm still talking, Jan. So, I actually loved the experience. It was very difficult. My mom set the house on fire twice. She flooded the place a few times. There were numerous escapades that we had to go to the hospital for. But her personality was just so sweet and kind. And I know I dodged a lot of aggravation and problems with traditional dementia, Alzheimer's, because she did stay so solid. There was only a few episodes where she was really, out of character. I'll put it that way. It was like it was like a group effort. And she got injured at one point relatively early on and hurt her hip. It was spider line fractures in her hip. And so we had to have a care aide come in regularly. And we had this woman come in, Berenice Berry, and she immediately alienated my ex-girlfriend who was living with us at the time, just because she was, in her mind, she grew up with house help. I never did that. I never had that experience, but she grew up in a much more upper middle class with maids and stuff like that. So she was used to bossing around people. And I was like, you don't talk to her like that. She's my mom's care aide. That's it. That's all she does. That's it. And Berenice really rose to the occasion, really took care of my mom, but it was causing all this shit with my girlfriend that we ended up getting during a break, we ended up getting somebody else. And thankfully, this other person that came in really, really alienated her. So we were all like wanting Berenice to come back, and she did. And she ended up spending the better part of 2 years, mostly part-time, 3 or 4 hours a day. That's all we could afford. But she spent a lot of time here. She'd bring her daughter, little Berenice, little Berry, and they really changed my mom's life. And I don't know how I would have reacted. This never would have happened had I not been in AA, period. This never would have been ha happened if I hadn't dealt with how I lived my life and how I lived. My reactions were always about me and what I can gain from something and stuff. And now I was like the reverse parenting kind of thing, right? Taking care of my mom. It wasn't easy. It was really difficult, especially when she's like determined to ignite the house on fire. But man, she was just so lovable to me. It became more d deeper, richer. I didn't feel this way upon her dying. I'll say this. She died in March of 2020, early March, March 11th. And it wasn't because of COVID. It was because she was having ongoing seizures. And eventually her heart was giving out. And she had a DNR, and I couldn't ignore the DNR on one of the occasions. I did it twice before. One of the occasions that the it wasn't just EMT, it was paramedics that came, and they have like a more military authoritarian kind of quality about them. And no one had asked me in the past about a DNR, which is a do not resuscitate for anyone who doesn't know. And I just started bawling. I said, yeah, it's on the refrigerator. Like, it's on the refrigerator. And they read it. And this is when they were in the midst of reviving her that last time. And I'm going to start crying now. Anyway, they read that and they said, stop everything. Everything's done. And at the time, her hospice nurse was coming with another woman. And Berenice wasn't here. We had a girl come in her stead about a month prior because she had moved to Connecticut, but she was still in constant contact with us. And, I didn't know what to do. I was like lost. I called my auntie, my mom's only living sister. I called my sister in Ireland. I called my sister, who I don't particularly like. And I called my younger brother. My older brother had passed in 2017, right after we got this house ship shaped for my mom to move in. He got cancer, and he had stomach cancer, and it exploded in June of 2017. So it was on the heels of my mother moving in, and he ended up dying in December of 2017 of the cancer. So it was like pretty, he was my one go-to in the States that I could really count on. My younger brother had three young daughters, and he was go he'd gone through a divorce, and he was still single parenting for the most part. So it was tough to nail him down with anything. But my older brother was a massive loss for me, again, on a bunch of fronts. And so anyway, my mom died in March of 2020. And of course, the country shuts down, the state shuts down. We have one of the last official real funerals in the state. Where everybody is 6 feet away, except when they're right behind you, then they're right behind you in the church. But it sucked in one regard, is that whatever living older folks could come out couldn't, that would have been able to make it couldn't because of fear of COVID. But it still was a beautiful affair. A bunch of people I know from my work came, a bunch of people from sobriety came, but a lot of living relatives that could do it made the trip and came. And some friends from the old neighborhood. And my point being is that I did something that was not particularly, I did something with help, mind you, but I did something from start to finish that was very, very difficult. It was emotionally ugly and sticky at times. It was physically demanding. I was working during this time too, so it was a little, I took a couple of hits with work. It was financially troubling because we was like a lot of our stuff was intermingled. And this is the first time I'm actually sharing about this in depth since it happened. So I apologize if I go over long on it, but it was like really the insight. It took me a while, but after my mom passed in March, I went on Zoom after meeting started going to Zoom. My last meeting at the homeless shelter was like March 16th or 19th, I can't remember. And there was like four people at it, and then it shut down for good. And I don't think I went to any other meetings, but that's not true. I went to one other meeting, and even though COVID was like looming, I had all these women, like older women at the noon meeting, give me this massive hug, which was very sweet, but also scary in light of the COVID. But my point was is that this is something I did in sobriety that never would have been possible had I not gotten sober. And I mean that in the fullest sense. Like there's a lot of flaws in my program, or whatever it should be called, in the way I do things. But most of them are measured, and they can be reflected on and brought back into what someplace something akin to way I want to achieve. And that was never a reality until I got sober and learned to speak about all of this stuff. And so anyway, after a few months, I stopped going to Zoom meetings, and it was in the hot of COVID, right? That first 6 months of COVID. And I went back to work. I went full bore into work. I was the only one on the job wearing a respirator mask all the time. I ate lunch alone. I was grieving, but I was like still very, very much involved in life. But I was blaming myself for my mom's death because of that DNR. And I didn't realize it. I didn't realize I was blaming myself. And it was my aunt who pointed it out. And again, these aren't things, this is hard to imagine. These are leaps of faith for me because this is not emotions that I was accessible to talk about even 15 years ago. So in sobriety, this was stuff I was not capable of talking about, period. It was not on the radar. This is even after going to therapy. I could talk about shit in therapy, but I could not bring it out, And I'm a slow learner in that regard. So anyway, it took a long time for me to forgive myself for my imagined wrongdoing with my mom, and to realize just what a special thing it was to like really realize that I really crossed the threshold. I miss her terribly, but based on where her dementia was taking her, she would have been incomprehensible not a year after she, that happened. So anyway, now it brings us up to 2024. I would like to speak. I really like to speak more about my family, but I'm going to hold my tongue on that. My mother was the daughter of an alcoholic, a very bad alcoholic. He was a one of the guys that would. He died in a flop house in Newark, New Jersey, not too far from Broad and Market Street, and at least that's the way I had heard it. My family conflicts on this on these points. So, and he died before I was born. He died in 1958. So it was like 4 years before I was born. I never got to know him, but I got to know his wife, Delia, who was a stalwart and an amazing person, not only in my life, but especially my mom's life. And in my auntie's life, she's still alive. I still talk to her regularly. I'm going to call her after I get off the Facebook thingy, whatever, Zoom. I have good relationships with these people now. So I lost my track there. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's always when you want to grab back at something, you can't. But regardless, none of this stuff was possible, period. None of it. And me having this conversation, this kind of intimacy, not even fucking close, But I can honestly say I didn't have a very reflective life, even though, I thought I was. I thought I was a reflective person. I thought I was, a deep thinker and a spiritual person. And all of it was mere veneer. It wasn't actual. It wasn't real. And it couldn't be realized until I let go of a lot of shit, a lot of stuff that's like that I still have to occasionally revisit, on the regular. This guy Stanley used to come to the Barrow Mansion. I was celebrating like 2 years and I was actually feeling good. I had a sponsor. I was celebrating. I was like really into it. And he used to sit in the back and he had this deep keeper of the crypt kind of voice. And he was sitting there and I said, I feel really good. I feel like I'm genuinely celebrating. I'm really happy. My heart's doing this little happy dance and I feel great, but I don't trust it. I don't trust it at all. I feel like any minute it could just shift up and find cheaper, the insanity can just shift and find cheaper real estate in another part of my cranium. And he just went, amen to that, baby. You can guarantee it. And that has been sort of like one of those things that has stuck with me ever since. So this is like, they used to use this, there was a game down the shore at Seaside Park. It was called Whack-a-Mole. It might be in Europe too, I don't know, but it has these moles pop up and you hit them with like a little plastic sledgehammer or whatever. And that's what everyone was saying at the time. That was the metaphor for a lot of our illnesses, a lot of our various illnesses that inhabit us, psychological and otherwise, that they're like whack-a-mole. You're always sort of combating them here and then they rise up on another front. And it's so true. To me, it's true. Like self-doubt, self-seeking, things that you hear in AA that are ego-driven, I still have them in spades. I don't think I'll ever be completely done with them, but I do have hope that they'll be without echo or they're voiceless, on more than one occasions. So I will still say this too. At the lowest part of my early sobriety, I was going to my brother's house, my younger brother's house, to pick up money that my sister sent from Ireland to keep me from fucking the clutches of absolute poverty. And it was not a happy occasion. I'm driving over on this one main thoroughfare. It's like two-lane highway both ways. It's a mess. It's got all kinds of shit on it, billboards everywhere. It's just dirty and pothole ridden. It's a truck route, so it's really super slow. And it has an Indian temple on it that had just started at the time. It's now very polished and shiny and has all kinds of neat stuff. But at the time, it was just nondescript, and it had sort of a sandwich board with removable letters out front, and it had the inspirer's name, inspirer, whatever. And then, but it, I never saw a sign there before, and I had traveled that road many years. But that day, there was a sign when I was going to my brother's house, and it just said, "One improved person improves the world." That's it. That's all it said. I had been on the way up to that sign. There's two big billboards. One was a whole Bible quote about no Jesus or no hell or whatever. I don't know. And the other one was a menage a trois themed. It was a Tanqueray or Drambuie or some kind of liqueur. It's a multiracial, beautiful people billboard about drinking. So there's like those are the two polars that I'm being presented with as in early sobriety. You have this drinking and this illusion of fun and sexiness, and then there's the depths of hell, which is where I feel like I rightfully belong in, but I reject religion. And here's his sign: one improved person improves the world. And I get to my brother's house, and my little niece Izzy, she's about 3 or 4 at the time, maybe 5. She was probably 5. But she sees me. I'm sitting there waiting for my brother to come out. They're having a yard sale of all things, and I'm sitting on their wall near their house and talking to my nieces and everything. And she just comes up and sticks a little sticker on me. The kids had a million stickers back then. I don't know if they still do. I don't look at it. I don't see it. My brother and I have a conversation. It's obvious he's very disdainful of me. I feel like shit when I leave him. My sister-in-law, my ex-sister-in-law, was much sweeter. My nieces were wonderful. But I leave there, and I get a little bit from his house, and I start bawling. I start crying. I'm like fucking ashamed. I feel like I've been found out as the worst person ever. And on the collar of my shirt is this little sticker, and all it says is hope, And I'm not a big hope person. I'm not like one of these people. I used to say, even after that, live in hope, die in despair. But I've since toned that bit down a bit. I do believe her little gift to me that day really helped me sort of, raise not only raise my spirits, but sort of like push me back into the game a little bit, feel better about myself. It was these little gestures. And that's how I feel about AA now. Like, what do I give to AA and to anyone in recovery and to anyone in life that's having a hard time? Is like these little gestures can really add up, can really help people. The takeaway is to be as kind, as loving, as tolerant as you can be. I mean, I still have my issues with Nazis, rightfully so. And I have my problem with some of the more intolerant members of our illustrious country. But I feel like I can access kindness even to them now, which I never would, which would be anathema to my very existence just a few years ago. I don't let them off the hook. I don't have to. I can let them know exactly how I feel, but I can be kind about it as much as I can access, like I said. Anyway, I hope I didn't, I know a friend of mine said, "Man, we should bottle that and sell it. That's a quick cure for insomnia, Bob. You should be proud." And so anyway, thanks for letting me share. Appreciate it.